This is the Sports Illustrated Boxing Podcast.
It's boxing.
A look inside boxing with Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix. Interviews, analysis, and everything going on in boxing. And now a man who I wish was called the Boston Bleeder.
All doctors to the ER.
It's sort of like getting punched in the face.
Chris Mannix.
All right, welcome back to the SI Boxing Podcast. On this episode, we'll discuss Gennady Golovkin's win over Steve Rolls, what that means for a Canelo matchup, also more fallout from Anthony Joshua's stunning loss to Andy Ruiz, Tyson Fury, he's got a big fight coming up, and Maurice Hooker and Jose Ramirez are going to meet for the unified 140-pound championship. A little bit later on, Jamel Herring, the now 130-pound title holder, he'll join the show. A lot to get into with him as well. As always, best way to support this podcast, head over to Apple Podcasts where you can post a rating or leave a comment. It's easy. It's free. It's the best way to make sure that we keep doing this podcast week after week. Also, if you like basketball, subscribe to the Crossover Podcast. That comes out every week as well. All right, joining me now, the former junior welterweight champion. He just picked up a win over Tommy Coyle a couple of weeks ago. Also, the author of The Fighter's Kitchen, his guide to eating healthy for the fitness-oriented. He is Chris Algieri. What's up, Chris?
What's going on, Chris? Thanks for having me, man.
Good to have you in here, man. Thanks for coming in studio. We're going to get into the book and your future plans as well, because in addition to being an author, you're still an active fighter
out there
looking for a significant fight. But you've done a lot of analyst work in the last few years as well, and you were at the Golovkin-Canelo fight.
Yes.
Not unexpected to see Golovkin knock out, Golovkin Rolls, not Golovkin-Canelo. We'll get to that as well. Not unexpected to see Golovkin stop Steve Rolls. I know there was maybe more of an anticipation of an upset given what we saw a week prior with Andy Ruiz, but Steve Rolls is not Andy Ruiz, does not have the amateur background, does not have the power to stop Golovkin. The same way Golovkin's not Anthony Joshua. He's got a granite chin, if nothing else, at this stage. But you saw it, 4+ rounds. What did you make of Golovkin's performance against Rolls?
You know, we've got of Golovkin who he's been out of the ring for some time. His last fight was the Canelo fight.
September, right?
Twice since then. Golovkin is a little older now. You know, he's 37. He's got a new trainer. So there was a lot of questions how this fight was going to play out. I didn't have a lot of questions about Rolls. I really didn't give him much of a chance. Even the puncher's upset chance, like Andy Ruiz had the weekend before, like you said, completely different guys, completely different matchup. Triple G did fight. I mean, the knockout was beautiful. The way he got the knockout in traditional Triple G fashion, big left hook. You know, once he gets you hurt, pours it on, finishes you, gets the guy out of there. I mean, face down knockout. You can't beat that. But up until that point, there was some holes, some things that I saw with Triple G, maybe defensively getting hit with some shots that you wouldn't normally see him get hit with. Part of that could have been transitioning to the new style, because he did move his head a lot more, actually. It was a lot of herky-jerky, tick-tocking of head movement, which I was very impressed with at first, because he was moving his head well. I've never really seen him do that. He's usually so methodical and kind of mechanical. But this fight, he had a lot more of like a rhythmic upper body movement. I'm not sure that he's figured that out completely yet, because he did take some punches, some pretty clean shots from Rolls, especially as the rounds went on. But I think overall it was a good performance coming back against an undefeated guy, and to put him away the way he did, I would say it's an impressive performance.
Yeah, the head movement, it looks like that's something that Jonathan Banks wanted to bring out of Golovkin. And you've changed trainers before in your career. This was a short training camp that Golovkin had with Banks. I think it was 5-ish weeks that they had together up in Big Bear. How big an adjustment is it, you know, especially for an established fighter, which you've been as well, as you make a trainer change, to adjust? Does it take more than one fight? In that first fight, is there some growing pains?
100%. Definitely takes more than one fight. It depends on how the fighter and the trainer mesh during their camp, how much time they have together. Like you said, there's only five weeks or so. That's not much. I'm surprised there was any change in Triple G, honestly. You know, you got an older guy. You got a guy whose style is very established. For him to go out and try new things, that's pretty cool. That shows a lot about the fighter that he is, that he's willing to keep learning at this point, and that he trusts his new trainer in Banks to try these things out there. And that's part of it too. You're trusting in what your trainer's telling you to do, and then you're going to go out and try it. And what happens a lot of times is maybe certain parts of it won't work and you won't feel comfortable, and either you keep working and push through, or you just revert back to who you are and you go back to your style and say, that wasn't really for me. Mm-hmm. I'd like to see where Triple G goes with this and this kind of style adjustment, see if he keeps on with it or if he just goes back to normal Triple G style.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much
Banks can change him or that he should change him. My big question with Golovkin is that at 37 years old, you lose something. Mm-hmm. I mean, time, it wins every battle. Bernard Hopkins fought it back longer than most, but Father Time is undefeated. Did you see anything, specifically when it comes to the defense, you know, instinctually, did you see anything different there with whether it was, you know, Golovkin, he was never a traditional, like, you know, Floyd Mayweather duck shots. He was our defensive fight. He parried a lot of shots in his career, but a lot of times he would go through shots just to land a big punch of his own. Did you see anything different kind of instinctually in what he was able to do in the ring? Because Rolls had a really effective second round.
Yes.
I mean, he landed, I thought he won the second round. Mm-hmm. He landed a lot of clean shots that if it were a bigger puncher, you wonder how what kind of effect it would have on Golovkin.
Yeah, I was sitting next to Louis C.K. during the fight, and he's a huge boxing fan. So we were talking throughout the whole time, and I said, I wouldn't be surprised if Rolls kind of finds out that he can hit Golovkin and has better rounds as we go on, but I still think he's gonna get caught and finish by the third. It took him a round longer, but it's exactly what happened. First round he didn't do much, and then second round he landed some punches and he's like, hey, I can hit this guy, and started throwing more. And like you said, like, he probably won that second round. Triple G took back over almost immediately in the third, and you know, obviously finished him in the fourth. But I don't know. I don't know if I can blame the porous defense on maybe his age, and he's not as smooth as he was transitionally moving his head and making a guy miss, or if it's because he was trying new techniques. You know, that could definitely be part of it too. Age gets us all, but I think that Golovkin's style is one that age may not affect as much as, say, like a Roy Jones Jr., mm-hmm. where reactions and speed and explosiveness, you know, are your mainstay. So I think it's yet to be seen whether that was an age-related or maybe just a style difference.
Yeah, he still has the blunt power, which is going to be with him.
And the finishing instincts.
Exactly, for the rest of his career. I did notice that the knockout punch was a switch to southpaw. I hadn't seen him do that much, had you?
He did his traditional overhand left where mm-hmm. he hit rolls on top of the head. When he does that normally.
That, to me, was the like, he wasn't finished there, but he was kind of finished there.
That's,
like, that discombobulated him.
That's
that was the Ruiz shot, it looked like. The one that mm-hmm. Ruiz hit Joshua with first that sent Joshua's legs into spaghetti in the third round.
Those are those equilibrium shots. They compress your neck. You don't expect to get hit. They hit you. You think you're covering up, and you think you're in a protected state, and then you get cracked on top of the head. Marcos Maidana was very good at that as well. He would crack guys right on top of the head. He did it with his right hand. Triple G does it with his left. A lot of times, if he cups you with something and he thinks he hurt you, when they cover up, he goes right to that shot over the top, take the legs a little bit, and then he looks to finish you up on the chin. There was a lot of talk from a lot of people were talking to me about the switch to southpaw. Like, wow, that was a southpaw punch. I mean, in the process of trying to finish a guy off, a lot of times you're throwing big shots and you fall into different stances. And I think it was just that. I think it was just kind of loading up. It's a brilliant way to generate power. You know, stepping through on a right hand, landing that southpaw position, and then rip the left hook from there, which is exactly what ended the fight.
It was almost Pacquiao-esque with that shot because it was straight. It was a straight line. You fought Pacquiao.
Yes.
And that sort of like straight line lunge in and hit you, it felt like that.
Yeah, they're hooking shots, but they land linearly. Because of the angle that's created from them stepping through or being southpaw, or being in a different stance. That just goes to Triple G's ability to finish and find openings. Really
so,
nice stuff.
So there'll be, we're now kind of barreling towards Golovkin-Canelo 3 in September. I mean, Golden Boy is, I think they're more posturing than anything else. I mean, Oscar's putting out tweets saying, go win a belt. Or anything. You really want to fight Demetrius Andrade next and put that, you know, that fight in jeopardy. You know, I talked to Eric Gomez about this on Saturday, and he said, look, there's no front runner right now. We're going to meet with Canelo later on this week. But I just, there's going to be a lot of pressure from DAZN, which didn't sign Canelo to this kind of deal to have him fight Callum Smith or even Demetrius Andrade now mm-hmm. or Sergey Kovalev, which is somehow on their radar at 175 pounds. Same thing with Golovkin. Like, he signed a big deal largely to get them to September for a third fight against Canelo. As an observer, though, is Golovkin-Canelo an interesting fight to you? Is that still a fight that at this stage of both their careers that Golovkin can win?
From my perspective and my personal choice, I don't love I don't love hearing about that fight or having that fight happen again. I think Canelo's going to win. I think, and it kind of takes away from Triple G, because really I thought he won the first fight. Second fight, could have gone either way. You could tell me, if you told me that Canelo won or Triple G won or it was a draw, I was happy with the second fight. But the third fight, I think Canelo's going to win. He's inching closer. He's figuring out the style more. He's not aging as fast as Triple G. So it looks like Canelo's getting better. And Triple G may be somewhat sliding. So I don't know. I have a feeling that Canelo wins that fight again. But honestly, for the public, that fight is the fight that's going to happen. It has to happen. You know, that's what people are clamoring for. You know, Triple G's 0-1-1 in this series. I'm sure he'd like to get back and get another one, and then maybe we get a fourth fight. Who knows? So, you know, the opportunity and the money that's there, and the outside of the boxing enthusiast eyes that'll be there, it's important for the sport.
Yeah, I'm with you on everything there. With the first fight, I thought it was a pretty clear Golovkin win, not by a wide margin, but I mean 118-110. We can just laugh that one off. Yeah. And I'm still sore over Don Trella's seventh round in that fight. I mean, even Adelaide Bird scored the seventh round for Golovkin, and Don Trella had the other way. And if that had gone Golovkin's way, it would have been a split decision in favor of Golovkin, and this would have been a rubber match, which I think would have increased the interest in it if it was an official rubber match instead of it being 0-1-1. I also agree with you that I don't know what Golovkin's path to victory is here, because I think we've found out over 24 rounds that he's not able to stop Canelo Alvarez. You know, in that last fight, Canelo stood there in the middle of the ring and traded punches with Golovkin.
And took big shots.
And took huge shots. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to say walk right through him, but he was there every single time. And for the first time in Golovkin's career, he was fighting off his back foot. Now, Jonathan Banks has said repeatedly that they need a new strategy. They need a strategy that'll beat everybody out there. They need a new strategy to beat Canelo Alvarez. They need to figure out something when the opponent is in front of you and he's not backing up from your shots and he keeps moving forward. Canelo is the only fighter that's ever done that with Gennady Golovkin. And that's not something I don't know if he's capable of doing at this stage. He's capable of landing a big shot, but if Canelo can walk right through him, his hand speed is better. His defense, as you mentioned, kind of with the improvements, that seems to be improving.
Yeah.
It's a very narrow path to victory for me for Golovkin against Canelo.
Agree 100%. 100%. And we also, and to that point, we've seen two different Canelos against Triple G. We've seen the same Triple G against Canelo. Mm-hmm. So I agree with you. How is he going to make, can he make the changes that are necessary to win this fight?
You're a guy, too, that's moved up in weight for significant fights. I mentioned that Kovalev was on the Canelo radar. Callum Smith had his kind of audition on the card that you fought on a couple of weeks ago. You know, Canelo seems to be interested in legacy-defining fights. I think Callum Smith right now is number one at 168. I would like to see that fight marinate a little bit if Callum Smith can stay at super middleweight. Maybe he wins another title. Maybe he has a domestic fight against BJ Saunders. Maybe just fights on more undercards here or his own events here in the U.S. But how do you think Canelo would fare against these bigger top opponents? Because I throw out Rocky Fielding because he wasn't there to win necessarily. No. He's a good fighter, but not a fighter on Callum Smith or Kovalev's level. How do you think Canelo would fare against those top guys?
Fielding was also completely tailor-made for Canelo. I honestly think Callum Smith is a beast. That guy, I mean, he looks so impressive knocking out Ndam the other night. Ndam, if he's nothing else, he is a tough, durable guy, and he's been in with some great fighters and has made fights out of them. You know, so for Callum Smith to go out there and to completely demolish him the way he did with perfect technique, I mean, he fought a perfect fight. He looked fantastic. He's big. He's strong. He's long. I think stylistically, that's a tough fight for Canelo. And I also think the risk versus reward is not there. Mm-hmm. You know, he's a dangerous guy. He's a bigger guy. You're moving up. And we don't know how good he is yet. We don't know where he could be. You know, that fight might make a lot more sense in some time as we start to learn who Callum Smith is and he starts to, you know, dispatch more and more of these top guys, which I think he will. And the Kovalev fight, that makes sense in terms of the chasing greatness, career-defining shot, you know, opportunities for Canelo. Because Kovalev's a beast and has been for so long. Is he the same guy he was? No. I thought he was really impressive in his comeback fight against Alvarez. He went out there, he changed his style up, he boxed, he was smart using his jab, and he still showed his power. He was still the Kovalev that we know. He just didn't finish Alvarez, but Alvarez is a very good fighter. That fight would make more sense in terms of the risk versus reward. I still think it's a very big risk because the size difference is substantial. Kovalev's a big guy. Mm-hmm. He's tall, he's long, and he has power. It's not just a big guy who's just has a bigger body, like maybe like a Fielding. He has the legitimate power at 175 where he's comfortable, and Canelo's just not that big of a guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think even 168 is pushing it. 75 is that's a reach.
Yeah, the one thing I like about the Kovalev fight is Kovalev has shown he's susceptible to body work, and Canelo's great at going to the body. You know, he will relentlessly attack there, and that creates kind of a path to victory. But it from a marketing standpoint or just a make sense standpoint, you do Golovkin in September, you do Demetrius Andrade in May when Andrade has time to build himself up even more in terms of a public figure. That's for the undisputed, if you keep winning, undisputed middleweight championship. And then you move up. Maybe Callum Smith has two titles in September of next year. Mm-hmm. Maybe he's still able to make 168. And all of a sudden, you have established yourself as the number one guy at 160. And you can go up to 168 in one fight, establish yourself as number one at 168. How many guys in boxing history have been able to say at the same time they've been the best in two weight classes? Not a lot of guys out there.
No, not a lot of guys out there. And I think Canelo's story,
like Roy Jones did it, you know, for a time. But that's Hall of Fame territory. Right, that's one of the Roy best Jones. Of all time.
That's Roy Jones. But I think Canelo's on his way there too. You know, his path to greatness has been laid out. You know, he's already a great fighter. He's already going to be going down in history as an all time great. I think what he does now in these next couple years could really solidify that and potentially be the, honestly, if he does the things that you just said, he's the best ever.
Mm. All right, let's talk about Anthony Joshua for a minute here. Joshua, he is still dealing with the loss to Andy Ruiz. He just left the U.S., back to the U.K., but we're already talking about the rematch, which is going to take place in the fall. I did an interview with Eddie Hearn last week, and one of the things Eddie said to me was that Anthony Joshua doesn't remember much after the third round of his fight. That's raised some alarm bells in some people that cover the sport and watch the sport. Do you find that? Did that raise any red flags to you? What did you make of that comment?
No, I don't think so. And I think that's something the fighters deal with. I've been in fights before where I got cracked and lost a few rounds. I lost a few rounds against Pacquiao. Like, lost meaning I don't remember the rounds. You're fighting off instinct. You're fighting off. You're still buzzed from whatever shot hurt you, or dropped you or whatnot. And you come back and you finish a fight or you don't, or the fight gets stopped or whatever. But it's one of those things where that's part of the sport. Our sport's dangerous. You know, things like getting dropped is not healthy. You know, getting knocked down. None of this stuff is healthy. Boxing is not a healthy sport. So if that happens, it happens. You just got to make sure that you do the right things in order to recover after the fight. And I'm sure Anthony Joshua's team is very, very smart and they're on top of him and making sure there's nothing going on, you know, in terms of brain bleeds or CTE, things like that. But no, I don't think that's that huge of a deal. I mean, you get dropped by a heavyweight. And, you know, you forget a few rounds and you wake up later, fight's over. It sucks, but it is what it is. You know, that's part of boxing.
Yeah, I don't know what, you know, somebody said to me like that the New York Commission would have a problem with that comment. I mean, what are you supposed to do? Do like a full medical workup on a guy after every round? I mean, fights would go forever if you tried to do something. It's just not practical to do something like that. But Joshua exercises rematch clause, which you expected, because if he didn't, he would have lost total control of the situation. And, and who knows when he'd be able to get Andy Ruiz back into the ring again. Who knows if Ruiz had the titles if that happened again. You know, people have gotten on me for saying Andy Ruiz has no power in this situation. He doesn't. He signed his name to a rematch clause in the contract. His name is on the contract. And it's not unusual either, right? I mean, you've taken your Pacquiao fight. Was that a mandatory or was that an optional?
That was an optional fight. I moved up to fight.
Okay, so but
I had to fight him again if I beat him.
Right, and so just explain that to people that are like stunned by the idea that Ruiz can't control anything despite the fact he's the unified heavyweight champion.
Right, so when you're in a position of power, as in Joshua was over Andy Ruiz before the fight happened, when you're signing the contracts, the guy in the lesser position wants to make the fight. So you agree to certain terms, certain deals in order to make the fight happen. In this case, it's a mandatory rematch clause that if Andy Ruiz were to win the fight, he has to immediately fight the champion if the champion wants. So a lot of that power is going to be in the champion's hands because you're coming up to fight them. That's just part of the paperwork stuff that happens prior to fights that no one ever hears about. But that's why that's what's happening with this rematch is happening right now.
And the specifics are pretty well laid out. I mean, I'm not sure how it was for you with Pacquiao, but you know, the money is generally said in these contracts, the location, or at least the control of the location is said in these contracts. There's very little left to negotiate, right?
No, the deals for fights like that, deals are done, you know, a couple in advance, you know, and even then you're talking about what happens when the other guy wins the second one. Is there a mandatory rematch clause? And again, like you said, the monies are a lot of times laid out for these deals in advance. for these fights, which may or may not ever happen. So those deals are done, and those details are already established. So there's not a whole lot of wiggle room there.
Yeah, but, I mean, look, one thing about Andrew Ruiz, if he wins this fight, and Eddie Hearn has said this publicly, he's free and clear. There's not options on him after that. If he beats Anthony Joshua a second time, he can go back to the PBC side of the street, fight Deontay Wilder, fight Tyson Fury if he's available, and do all that. But the rematch itself, right now they're debating whether to put it in the U.K., or back in New York in the U.S. Apparently, Joshua has a strong interest in fighting here in New York to kind of exorcise his demons, to come back to the place where it all went wrong and set it right. Eddie Hearn, it seems like he's a little more interested in moving the fight to the U.K., where Joshua would be far more comfortable. It'd be in front of 70,000 fans in Cardiff, Wales. And Joshua would have kind of his routine back again, where he'd be able to go into his home environment and fight this fight. Which makes sense given the stakes of this fight. If Joshua loses to Ruiz, it's a massive rebuild. He doesn't become David Price, but he's on the David Price sort of track after that. If you were advising Anthony Joshua, what would you tell him? Where would you tell him to have the rematch?
Fight in the States. Get it back. I'm picturing Lennox Lewis, Haseem Rahman. You know, you got to make a statement. You got to go right after the guy. Immediate rematch. Go right back to where you into the lion's den. I am very impressed with Joshua, the fact that he wants to like you said, exercise his demons in the room where he failed, and to bring it back, run it back again. Give me another shot. I'm gonna do it this time. And for me as a fighter, for me as an athlete in this sport, that's the way to go.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you. I think that you make the point about Rahman versus Lewis, and Rahman or Lewis. Settled that clearly. Blasted Haseem Rahman out of there. I also, if social media was around when Buster Douglas beat Tyson, we'd be, Tyson would be buried. If it was around when Lewis lost to Rahman, Lewis would be buried. I am astonished at how many people out there, even some media people, are just leaving Anthony Joshua as dead and buried. Yeah. He had a terrible night and had a terrible game plan. Mm-hmm. I don't think he took Andrew Ruiz all that seriously. He had a training camp that was in Miami that I don't think he'll ever do again. So I hope the people out there that if Anthony Joshua goes out and blasts out Andrew Ruiz, which is distinctly possible, no matter where that fight takes place, I hope they give him the credit and don't just bury him again after all that.
No, I agree. I agree. I'm a huge Anthony Joshua fan. I still am. I think there's a lot yet to be seen with what happens in the rematch. But no, I agree 100%. People are really just kind of walking away from the whole situation, and I don't think it's necessary. I don't think it's he's deserving of that. You got to give him a shot. See what happens in the rematch.
Yeah. The one thing I wonder about, and I think that there's going to be some changes there. And Sergio Moro and I had this argument on the last podcast, pretty vocally, actually.
Argument with Sergio Moro, really?
But the idea that there maybe should be changes in Anthony Joshua's corner. He's been with Rob McCracken since the Olympics. Mm-hmm. Look, there's a lot of loyalty there when you have a guy that's been with you from the very beginning. But the game plan wasn't great. Joshua fought off his back foot and fought backing up the entire time. Do you think there needs to be some kind of change, whether it's a complete overhaul or adding something to your corner after a fight like that?
That is dependent on the athlete themselves. If they've gotten to the point where they're complacent with their coaching staff and the coach can't get them to make the changes or can't get them to do the things, because a lot of times when you're with someone for so long, it's you're hearing the words, you're hearing the words, you're agreeing, you're nodding, and then you go out and do your own thing. So if he needs some fire lit under him to get him to make an adjustment, then I think that's up to the athlete to maybe bring somebody in. I don't think they should ever get rid of anybody. Maybe he takes a different position. Even myself, I've had Keith Trimble in my corner for my entire boxing career. Even though Andre Rozier is my head coach, they're both in the corner together. They work together. I never got rid of Keith Trimble. He's been there.
Okay, so just pause there. Tell me about why you decided to add to your corner and what was the impetus for that.
So I felt that I needed the right kind of voice in the corner. And from all the time that I had spent in the camps with Daniel Jacobs alongside Andre Rozier, we developed a relationship, and I understand. I was working corners with all of Danny's sparring sessions. I was working corner with Andre. All of my sparring sessions, I had Andre in my corner because I was sparring alongside Daniel when he was in camps, wherever we were. So I have a lot of experience hearing Andre's voice in the corner, and he was able to get me to do things in the ring and in a fashion that fit me and my style. So for me, it was more of the corner work and having that relationship and having that voice in my ear in between rounds, why Andre Rozier is my head coach and the guys in front of me. But now in my career at this point, I've got Andre and Keith in my corner at all times. They both speak. They both refer to each other. Mm-hmm. They're both very much on the same line in terms of what kind of technique they want me to do, but Andre just says it in a way differently. It's semantics. Mm-hmm. I just understand the way he speaks better. So it's one of those things, that's a very specific individualized thing, for the athlete, which is why I said about Anthony Joshua, if he's going to bring in somebody new, it's up to him whether he needs it.
Is he the only one that can kind of come to that conclusion? I mean, Rob McCracken's not going to fire himself.
Right.
Is it incumbent just on Joshua to decide, hey, I need something more? I mean, this is something I would ask if they were sitting here. I'd ask Lennox Lewis and I'd ask Vladimir Klitschko, yeah, two guys that made significant changes after their losses, both going to Emmanuel Stewart, who was incredibly influential in them turning into the Hall of Fame fighters that they became. But is there anyone that, I mean, put it this way, is it Eddie Hearn's responsibility to put that in his ear, or is it anybody else's responsibility?
It's the fighter. The fighter's in the driver's seat. At the end of the day, they're going in the ring alone. And what they feel comfortable with, what their corner and what their corner is telling them and what their training camps look like is entirely up to them. So that is 100% the decision of the fighter themselves about who's going to be steering the ship.
I always wonder what would happen if Emmanuel Stewart was alive, because it would almost be like three generations.
I'd be training with him. That's
but it would be three generations of big men that, yep, he would have a chance to mold, mm-hmm, into all-time greats. I mean, the 90s into the early 2000s, Lennox. 2000s, Vladimir. Then to get Anthony Joshua in his late 20s to maybe extend his career 10 years. Mm-hmm. And I think Lennox could do a lot. I think that Emmanuel could do a lot with Anthony Joshua. I mean, I said this on previous podcasts, he fights like Mike Tyson when he should be fighting like Lennox Lewis. Like he's sort of like this, yep, big, strong guy that wants to come in and flatten you with, mm-hmm, those big hooks, when the reality is he should be fighting off that jab. Now, I'm not a boxer, but it just seems like when you're that big and you have the ability to do what Vladimir did, you should do it. You should fight that way.
That's a great point, Chris. I agree with you. I think that he shouldn't be worrying so much about blasting people out. He's a boxer. He's a boxer puncher. I've said it time and time again in every interview I do. I'm like, if I was going to make a heavyweight champion in a video game, I would make Anthony Joshua. Mm-hmm. That's the guy. He's got boxing skills. He's got the size. He's long. He's strong. He's physical. But sometimes I think he goes out there and he's just looking for the bombs when he actually has a beautiful jab and smooth movement and defense and footwork. He's got everything. Literally has everything. Now it's up to him whether to use it or not. But I think with this fight, I would like to see him come back, use those skills on the rematch with Andy Ruiz. He's going to have to. If he meets him head on, it could be the same thing again.
He needs to use that jab and with force, too. Yes. Like Golovkin throws a power jab. Mm-hmm. Lennox Lewis threw a power jab. Yeah. Vladimir threw a power jab. Against Ruiz, he was using that jab a little bit, but it was just this soft, like, belly touches and little pops.
He was just off all around.
Yeah.
He was off all around, and he still dropped Ruiz. That's my kind of beacon of hope that I think that, Joshua's going to come back and do what I want him to do, or what I would expect the heavyweight champion to do. Because he just seemed completely off. I don't know if it was the moment. I don't know. You don't know what's going on in camp. That's something you don't know either with a fighter. You don't know how camp went. You don't know. Like, there was some hearsay about he got dropped in camp. That stuff happens, mm-hmm, and you carry that. And whether you carry it psychologically or physiologically is very for real. Thinking in the back of my mind, ooh, I got cracked. I got dropped in my last sparring session. Some guys, that goes right out the window. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. But then also physiologically, maybe you're a little bit still wrong. So now the punches hurt you more than they normally would. So there's a lot of things that can happen in camp. Again, it's all hearsay. You never really know what really happened, but yeah, you never know. So I just felt like Joshua was off that night.
Yeah, Joey DeVecco is the guy that allegedly put him down in camp.
Oh,
he's
really?
Fighting. He's fighting on the July 27th card in Texas. I'm guessing that's going to come up. I'm guessing that somebody's going to ask him about what happened there. The ripple effect from the Ruiz upset extended not just to Steve Rolls, but also to Tom Schwartz, who nobody in the United States has ever heard of, but has a sterling record. He looks like a heavyweight champion. He's about 6'5", muscular. He's taking on Tyson Fury in Las Vegas. You're headed out to Vegas. You're going to see that fight. I guess it's less about Tom Schwartz than about where Tyson Fury's at in his career. And just the visuals I see of Tyson Fury, Chris, he just seems like he's in the best possible place you can be after the Wilder fight. He didn't regress. He didn't gain weight. He didn't kind of go off the deep end. Mm-hmm. He stayed in camp. It looks like he's lost some weight.
Yeah.
It looks like he's in better shape than he was in for the Wilder fight. What do you make of where Fury's at right now, what you've seen just on video, whatever, of him?
Certainly the leanest I've ever seen him in terms of his physical fitness, the way he looks, doesn't necessarily mean that he's fitter. He, you know, that size might actually help him, because I've seen plenty of athletes that actually perform better with a little bit more body fat on them, especially in heavier weight classes. So that's really yet to be seen. But, you know, we'll see. I like the way Fury fights. I mean, he's fun to watch. You know, he throws a lot of punches. He boxes well. He's got frenetic head movement.
Best head movement I've seen in a heavyweight ever.
The fact that he keeps it up is really what's impressive. 12
rounds.
To me. 12 rounds like that. It's insane. But the thing about Fury is that he kind of needs the moment. So I'm worried about this fight. Because,
really?
Yeah, I am. And not so much that he's going to lose, but that he's going to look flat. Because he's done that before with the guys in the past. When he has his moment, he shines. When he fights Klitschko, when he fights Wilder, the amazing performances. But then the fights in between, as you know, his first fight back was kind of like ho hum. I'm afraid that'll happen here, and that a lot of the steam that are in, or a lot of the wind that's in the sails right now, might kind of fall off. I hope not. I hope he goes out there and does what he's supposed to do and looks fantastic and, you know, blows this all up. Because when the heavyweight division is alive and well, boxing is just a little bit better.
Mm. Deontay Wilder has said over and over again that you don't recover, or you're not the same fighter after the kind of punch he landed on Fury in the second round. It's his way of saying that in the rematch, he is going to be far better than Fury is. I'm not so sure. I mean, Wilder's getting a little bit older, and Fury, now if that knockdown doesn't happen, he wins the fight. He got caught twice, actually,
yeah.
But he was the better fighter on that night. I mean, Wilder has said, I won more of those rounds. I don't think so. I've watched that fight several times. I thought Fury, without the knockdowns, won pretty convincingly. If they do wind up meeting in February, who would you favor in a fight like that?
Well, first of all, I'd say that I thought Fury won the first fight, even with the knockdowns.
Okay.
I think that he won enough rounds. He was in control so much of the fight. In the rematch, I don't really agree. Maybe I do agree with Wilder and what he's saying, but maybe not the way that he means it. I think that gives him an advantage because he knows he can knock Fury out. Maybe at some point during that fight, he might have had some thoughts like, man, I can't hit this guy, or I hit him and he's taking it. But at that last round, he knows he can knock him out. He hit him with some amazing punches and dropped him. He got up, but you know, he's like, if I get this guy right, or if I can get him a couple times, I can get him out of there. So maybe psychologically having that in his mind can definitely help him in the rematch. But then also there's the flip coin is that Tyson Fury is like, he hit me with his best shot. I got up and I kept going, and I was like winning after he dropped me. So they're both very mental and psychological fighters, you know. So I think whoever's, you know, ego and aura and psychology is bigger and stronger than it's going to win that fight. That's what it comes down to. It's a war of characters right there. You know,
Fury's ability to stay busy as much as he is, like just throw punches, like that got to Wilder. And you know, yeah. Freddie Roach said after the fact that he wished that Fury had gone for a knockout there because he thought he was hurting Wilder.
I thought he was too. Yeah,
I thought he was. Yeah. He doesn't throw that big one punch bomb, but he connects with these sharp, you know, fast punches that you just don't see. Exactly. And Wilder, like, his chin is there. Like, you go back to the Brazil fight. I mean, Brazil was flattened. It was done. But after he pushed Brazil into the corner, Brazil caught him. He caught him with a punch, like, kind of the side of the head, and it stopped Wilder's momentum there a little bit. So whether it's that, it's the Fury fight. I mean, Wilder has shown that you can hurt him without the biggest of punch either. Mm-hmm. So I think Fury's I would make him the favorite in a rematch going into it.
The thing about Wilder, which is maybe why it's such high drama to watch him, is just that, you know, he can knock out anybody. That man can knock out a dinosaur. He's got power in both hands. He believes in it, but at the same time, he's 213 pounds, 216 pounds. He's small. He's small, and you got these big guys. These 240-pound, 250-pound guys, and they lay hands on you. He's been hurt. He's been shown to be hurt, he's kind of that Thomas Hearns, you know, effect where he's got long and strong and has that power, but at the same time, those legs go when they get hit. So when he gets hit, so you know that's what makes him, I think, so interesting. So yeah, that fight, it's still a 50-50. I liked what I saw in the first fight with Tyson Fury and this. I mean, the game plan's there. How to beat Wilder if you're Tyson Fury is there, but it's also there for Wilder. You know, Wilder could beat anybody doing the same thing that he does. But I think a lot of it's going to be the psychology of it. And I think Wilder's going to start that fight very fast.
Yeah, that's why I love the heavyweight division. A lot of good fighters, right, and nobody's invulnerable. Like, they're all vulnerable to get beat by something.
I think Luis Ortiz can beat any of those guys, too.
Yeah.
I don't think he does, but I think he can.
Yeah.
I think he can.
Wilder better watch out in that September fight. You better not do what Joshua did and kind of look past or look through somebody. Because Luis Ortiz can catch you and did catch Wilder in that first
go. How wild would that be? He beats Wilder and then we get an Ortiz Andy and Luis.
like networks everywhere going like, crap. Let's talk about you for a second here. You're two fights into your kind of return to the ring. This year, two fights, right? You had two fights this year. A great performance against Tommy Coyle and what was one of the best fights of the night. Thank you, Tommy Coyle, who just comes in there. I love Tommy Coyle in the fighter meeting. He's like, I want to box, but there's just too much thinking with that. Like, there's just, I just want to go out there and fight. And he did. He came to fight, and you put him down. You put him out. He quit in the corner after that. How much better was that performance from you from the one we saw earlier this year, which I think was a little bit disappointing for everybody involved in that first one?
Yeah, 100%. It was a completely different guy. It was a couple things. One, it was not fighting my sparring partner. That always sucks. But also, I had the flu the week of that fight. It was a nightmare. I was probably the worst I've ever felt in a ring in any of my careers, boxing, kickboxing, anything. I felt awful. I remember warming up and just being like, I'm not even here. It was a bad day at the office. I just had to go to work. It was one of those days that you wake up like, I can't pull out today. I gotta go to work. Mm-hmm. I gotta tie my tie tight and I gotta go in there and do what I gotta do. And it was one of those things like, I'm not losing this fight. I'm Mike, but I'll win this one. Look good next time. And that's exactly what ended up happening. And I think I think the Coyle camp looked at that last fight and they're like, oh, he's gonna fade. He fades late. Man, I've never faded in my career. Never been known for a guy who fades. And it's great because that's how the fight actually got stopped. Because Jamie Moore looked at me and he was like, that kid's not getting tired. And he said that to me. I had coffee with the guys the next morning. And Jamie's like, yeah, we were watching as we were going. You were tuning Tommy up. He's like, but Tommy was getting gassed. He's like, and you were not at all. I told him I would have won 20 rounds that night. Mm-hmm. So the way the fight ended and the way that it came about coming off of that last fight, I feel completely redeemed.
So you were hoping that win would lead to a world title shot, 140 pounds. That's obviously not going to happen now with Hooker and Ramirez set to fight July 27th. And presumably the winner of that fight, they'll at least try to make the winner of Josh Taylor versus Regis Prograis, which is also coming up in the fall. So it kind of boxes you out of the 140-pound title situation. What do you do then, though? How do you approach your career now, knowing that a 140-pound title shot is probably not in the offing for another year?
Yeah, but so let me just preface that the whole getting the title shot wasn't so much like I was expecting to win a couple fights and then get a title shot. It was just pushed on me so much by so many different people, and I couldn't get any question like, hey, who do you want to fight for? You want to fight Hooker? When you get asked those questions, you got to answer them. But for the most part, I wasn't thinking like, okay, my first fight back in 2 years is November. I'm gonna fight then in January. Then I'm having a title fight my next fight. No, but that's how it was presented a lot to me by a lot of different people who actually matter. But so there is disappointment because I felt like it was very, very close for me getting into that position. But for the most part, it is what it is. I go back to the drawing board. I keep fighting. I knew this was not going to be a smash and grab job for my return. It wasn't going to be like, all right, I get one fight and then look for a big fight. I'm here to win a world title. I'm not here just to make money or to get my shot. I want to earn my shot. I want to be prepared, and I think I'm getting better and better each fight with my comeback. 2.5 years is a long time not to fight. The longest I've been fighting professionally between kickboxing and boxing since I was 19. I've never had 2 years off. So for me to work through training camps again, work through fight weeks, work through a fight, I think that's been really beneficial. I don't know if I'm exactly there yet. I feel really good after the last fight. There's definitely things we can work on. But I just feel like I'm getting better all the time.
Is there an obvious big fight that you can pursue over the next year, or is it just a matter of let's stay as busy as humanly possible and hope that one materializes?
Yeah, I think staying busy and keeping my performance up. It's tough because the weight class is really young. Everybody in the weight class is really young, and they're all fighting each other. So like the top guys, the Ramirez, the Hooker, the Prograis, I'm missing this kid's name, Taylor.
Kelly's the smaller one.
I get the two of them confused. Taylor, not Kelly. Those are the top four guys, and they're all busy. They're all busy until maybe the end of the year. So, after that, even them, they're kind of young and really unknown to the boxing public. So beyond them, it's kind of like, all right, there's no real big fights. So I think just keep busy, get the right kind of fights, and like I said, keep working through this quote-unquote comeback of mine, and just keep looking impressive.
Actually, Josh Kelly's the bigger one. He needs to work on his jab after the Ray Robinson fight.
Yeah, I was surprised they even made that fight. Ray Robinson.
Was he 9-0 going into that? Like, that's a little early to fight a guy that makes guys look bad.
A Philly guy who can fight with 30 fights?
That might be biting off. But it did expose him a little bit, that another guy that needs to work on, you can't just throw flurries and expect to win a fight. Not against the guy.
You can't roll shoulders and let a guy work so much. And Ray Robinson's a good fighter. There's nothing to take away from Kelly for catching a draw with that guy, because the guy could fight.
Right, no question. In between, you are an author. Your new book, Fighter's Kitchen, that is out. Tell me about first of all, why write a book like this? I know you're also a nutritionist. You've worked with Daniel Jacobs, among others, but what was the impetus for writing a book like this?
So it's funny. I started working on a cookbook in training camp for the Pacquiao fight. I pretty much taught myself how to cook by being in training camps over the years since 2010. I moved to Oxnard in 2012 to train at Robert Garcia's gym. I lived in a hotel room. I literally was on a hot plate preparing my own food. My money was very, very slim at that time. And so I was preparing my own meals, and you know, Robert always, you know, said, he was like, you know, this guy's in great shape. He's always so fit. You should, you know, talk to Algeria about making weight, you know, all the guys in the gym. And that was kind of the advent of my social media, posting photos of my food. And it kind of blew up from there. A lot of people started catching notice of that. And I was like, I got something here. And by the time I got to the Pacquiao fight, I'd actually gotten pretty good at cooking. And I really do enjoy it. It's kind of my release after a long day of training. I get to come home and prepare myself a meal, and it completely removes me from training or thinking or fighting or boxing or whatever else I have going on. So that was when I was like, all right, I got time. There's a lot of time in the Pacquiao training camp, so the camp was super long, so I started writing down my recipes. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I got this idea. I wrote up a whole pitch. I'm going to find some people. I started talking to different photographers. Long story short, I kind of got busy with my fight career. Can't really get busier than Pacquiao, but you know, I was busy in that time. And out of nowhere, last summer, Penguin Random House reached out to me, and they're like, "Hey, we want you to author this book. We've got this project. What do you think about it?" I'm like, "I've been working on this for 5 years. Like, let's rock." Boy, was I wrong. I didn't scratch the surface of how much work this thing was. I am humbled by being an author. I tip my hat to anybody who's ever created a book. This is an entry into this, and I spent, from August until probably the middle of training camp of my January fight, every moment I wasn't sweating, wrapped up in ring gloves, I was on my computer working on this thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm very, very proud of it. It's something I've always wanted to be, is be a published author. I can say that now. And it came out great. And I'm really excited that it's selling really well and people are getting use out of it. And that's really what it's for. I'm just trying to share my experiences, my knowledge about being a nutritionist, my knowledge about cooking and culture, and to give people a kind of a layout for how they can eat healthy, live a fit lifestyle, and hell, you can even use it to train for fights.
It's a grind, man. I mean, I'm a writer by trade, mm-hmm. and I've been dabbling with a couple of books there, and I hate it. I legitimately hate it. I sit down, I'm like, I won't do this. This is like I'll go back to writing 2,000-word stories, and even that is like, oh, fuck, I just got to grind my way through this.
But the biggest thing, I'm sure you can attest to it, it's honestly just the mindset of sitting down and doing it. Because mm-hmm. there are days where I've got so many things going on, but I just feel like I can write, so I'll write. And then I have other days where I'm like, all right, I set aside a block of 6 hours, so I'm going to sit down and work. I will sit there and type 5 words. You know, it's about the mindset, and I think that's been really an interesting kind of thing for me to realize about writing. Mm-hmm.
So a book available Amazon, the usual spots.
Amazon, Barnes & Noble Booksellers came out last week. It's already a bestseller on Amazon, so hopefully we can get this thing cranking. Got a bunch of signings coming up.
Awesome, man. We're author, world champion, maybe future world champion, if you can get that title shot down the line. Chris Algieri, thanks for joining me, man.
My pleasure. Thanks, Chris.
All right, joining me now on the podcast, he is first and foremost a Marine, and he can now call himself a world champion, the new WBO junior lightweight champion to be specific, Jamel Herring. Jamel, congratulations, man.
Thank you. I appreciate it, man.
Now,
it means a lot.
Now, I didn't serve, but my father did, and a bunch of my friends did, and I learned very early on not to call someone an ex-Marine. Right?
Once a Marine, always a Marine.
I learned that very early. I was corrected very early in life on that. Has it set in? I mean, you're just about a week or so removed from winning that world title? What's the feeling now?
Like I said, it still feels like a dream at times until I actually get stopped by folks. Like today, I got stopped by somebody from the British, fans, had stopped me and just congratulated me, and it's just been a great roller coaster ride, but well worth it.
When you're standing there and you hear the scorecards being read, a couple of them were wide.
Right.
You've seen strange things happen in boxing. Was any part of you wondering? I'm like, is this? You probably think you won, but maybe this doesn't go my way.
Yeah, of course, especially when you're coming in as a challenger. We all seen it in world title bouts that. The craziest things happen. Like I said, we can even go back to the Munguia last fight. Many thought that he lost at times, and the scores were red and went the other way. So, like I said, it was never certain until I heard and knew.
Yeah, that lesson learned from Munguia. Never fight a Mexican fighter in Mexico. you kind of get what you run into if that happens.
Right.
In that moment, watching it live, then watching it back just a few minutes before I came down here, I mean, you fell to the mat when they said "and the new," what was going through your mind in that moment?
Just like you said earlier today, when you mentioned before we started, how you've covered me since the games, 2012 games. It's been an up and down, roller coaster ride for me. I never had anything handed to me. I don't believe I had the easy route, to the title. So when I heard Jimmy Lennon announce that I was the new world champion, I just felt all the emotion that I've been going through over the past, six, seven years now, because at one point in time, people counted me out, and just to, climb back up and, reach the pinnacle of the sport meant so much, especially on my daughter's birthday, of course, as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that, because did it mean more to you to have something like that happen on your daughter's birthday? Tragically passed away 10 years ago from sudden infant death syndrome. Did it fuel you at all going into a fight like that? And did it mean more to have it happen in that moment?
Oh, yeah, it definitely meant more. I mean, like I said before the fight, I said, if I don't do anything after this fight, I have to at least win this world title on her birthday. That will be, the best birthday gift that I could possibly give her in her honor, which is to win that title and bring it back home.
Are you, when you, the euphoria that must be washing over you kind of in that moment, when you watch it back on TV, you see all these people grabbing at you and yelling stuff in your ear. Do you even hear that stuff in that moment?
No, it's crazy. Like, I still had tunnel vision, so when I had to watch it myself after the following day or so, I just felt another side of emotion, from seeing all the people that were excited and all the joy in the ring at the time. And it just, it was just overwhelming. And I almost broke down again just watching it, because you can see that everyone was genuinely happy for me.
You go into a fight like that, and it's your first world title shot, but at this stage of your career, do you approach it like it might be your last world title shot?
Oh, yeah, of course. Like I said, before signing with Top Rank, people thought, my career was going downward. So I felt like every fight counts. Even after winning the title now, every fight still counts, because now it comes to the point where people are going to watch what you do as a champion and how you perform and basically represent the sport. So every fight counts, but that fight especially, I just felt like my back was against the wall. But at the same time, I didn't feel the pressure, as you may say, because I was already going in as an underdog, so I didn't have that pressure as people are watching to see, okay, you got to do this, you got to do that. Such as Ito, people were already saying, Burchell Ito. So I didn't really have the pressure. I just felt like, I just got to go in here and just be me.
And you must have incredible perspective on what pressure really means.
Right.
I mean, you're a gunner in the Marines, and you're dealing with sniper fire. I mean, it just boxing pressure must be a walk in the park by comparison.
Oh, yeah, of course. Like I said, like I said in the past, to me, boxing, when I had to deal with stuff in the Marine Corps, boxing to me was my therapy. So, of course, therapy is real relaxing for anyone, but so – like, when I was going in, I was just like, to me, it's another day at the office, but this is, the big promotion, such. So the pressure factor didn't really set in. I just went in there. As you can see, I stayed real disciplined. I was cool throughout the fight, calm, and I just stuck to my game plan.
There were a lot of cool moments involving the Marines that were there before the fight, you walking through the procession of them after the fight. The ring literally collapses yeah. by the weight of all those men and women standing there in the ring. I mean, what was that like to have kind of all your brothers and sisters there in the ring with you?
Oh, man, that, I don't think anything can top that moment because, for starters, the Marine Corps hasn't had a world champion since, I believe, 1982 with Mike Weaver. And Top Rank actually promoted one of his own fights during his reign. So to bring that title not only back to Long Island but to the Marine Corps as well, you know, we all felt that we won big, and I don't believe that anyone's going to top that feeling for a while.
When you look back at your time serving in the Marines, what did it do for you? I mean, you jumped, if reading your story correctly, like you joined the Marines to get away from certain things right. in your past life. What did it do for you?
For starters, I actually matured and became a man in the Marine Corps, because when I first enlisted, I was 17, turning 18 during basic training. So, you know, I was still a kid. And I believe over time, when I look at my Marine Corps career and what's it done in terms of for my boxing career, I believe it made me mentally strong. You know, if anything, it toughened me up mentally. Like, I felt like I've been through so much worse. You know, what's the worst that could happen with the sport, you know, inside the boxing ring? So the Marine Corps definitely, and they always say boxing is more mental than physical. So the Marine Corps definitely, you know, just made me mentally strong, and it just, you know, built strong character.
And do you think you would have been in boxing if not for the Marines?
Honestly, I don't even know. But I highly doubt I'll be where I'm at, because, like I said, the Marine Corps has done so much for me, in and out the ring. So I don't believe that I will be where I'm at, because, like I said, at the time I was a kid in New York trying to stay out of trouble. And it's easy to lose your focus out here in New York as well. So I think if it wasn't for the Marine Corps, I definitely wouldn't be here at all.
How many of those people in the ring did you actually know? Were you like...
Honestly, I didn't know them personally, but, like, you know, we all connect from just, you know, sharing that brotherhood. And like I said, I felt their happiness and they felt mine. And, you know, we all just went out like one big happy family. But like I said, personally, I didn't know them. But like I said, we all got to know each other very well after that night.
I saw, I think it was a tweet from Top Rank's Carl Moretti, who said, "I usually try to stop people from coming into the ring, but there's no way I was standing in the way."
Oh, no.
Not that he could, for that matter.
Yeah, like I made a joke about that. Like, you know, with Marines is always seek and destroy, and they had their mindset on getting in that ring. I mean, security, Carl, nobody could stop them from getting in that ring. And as you can see, we all destroyed the ring and fought right afterwards.
Take me back to, I mean, really just 2 years ago when, as you said, you were pretty much counted out. I mean,
right.
You had hit a stage in your career. You were in your early 30s. You had lost two of your last three fights. Mm-hmm. One of them was by stoppage. Did you feel at that time that your window may have passed?
No, not really. But I feel like it was definitely closing. I mean, of course, when you're looking at yourself personally, you always feel like you still have something left in you. But when the people on the outside looking at it, and the ones that actually control what maybe goes on in the sport, those are the people you have to really convince that, you know, there's still something there. So that was the main thing with me. And that's why I had to basically make a decision that is either stick around and still, you know, and spiral out of control, or, you know, lift yourself up and make that change.
What pushed you towards that change? What was the some of the driving forces?
I remember around that time, Terrence Crawford, you know, he was having a camp with Ndongo, and I was actually one of the sparring partners from that camp. And I was just picking his brain. Of course, Brian McIntyre and Red Spikes, Saul Diegas, all as well. I was just picking their brain and just watching and observing how they all conducted themselves in that camp. And I was just saying, like, you know, I never experienced anything like this, but I see that it's working well for Terrence. Maybe I need to get on board for something like this. And it wasn't until afterwards when I had lost that second fight and I seen how I was being, in my opinion, mistreated, that I had to reach out. And I remember them always leaving that door open for me. So I've seen that I convinced them that I can do it, but then I had to. Then it was to come to the point of the business side where I had to try to convince, you know, the promoters that I can do it as well.
How did you convince Top Rank that you could do it?
Truthfully, I have to give thanks to Brian McIntyre and Terrence for that, because they actually went to Top Rank and told him, like, hey, you know, he can really fight. He can fight. You just give him a shot and see what he can do, and I promise you that you'll be impressed. Because, like I said, the window was closing. You know, doors wasn't, you know, no one was knocking at my door, you know, for me to come on board at the time. So I had to basically, you know, take full advantage of the opportunity and roll with it.
Could you have continued under the PBC banner and doing what you were doing, or was that option off the table for you as well?
The option was actually still open. I mean, I remember Brian actually talking to them. You know, Bo went spoke to the PBC side, and I guess he didn't like the vibe that he was getting because we was trying to get a date, and they would say they had a date, but they wasn't giving us the exact date for us to prepare, and we didn't want to get hit off guard, and that was the problem I was having in the past. Like, you know, the Shavuco fight, I went in the fight, you know, on a 3-week notice. You know, the Darius Miller fight, I didn't have full preparation, so that's why I ended up sticking with Terrence Crawford in their camp, and they actually helped me get ready for that fight. So, like, you know, just Brian just looking on the inside how the business was running, he didn't like that, so that's when he took me over to Top Rank himself, and that's when him and Bud, on their behalf, convinced them to bring me on board.
It's nice when you have someone that swings a big bat.
Exactly, right, yeah.
Top Rank, it never hurts. When you linked up with BOMAC and started working those Crawford camps, were the changes in you, you know, stylistically, did you change how you fight, or was it more kind of a mental approach rebuilding certain things?
I believe it was more of a mental approach. Like, I remember the fight. I remember the fight. Like I said, I remember you was commentating as well, and I listened to everything everybody says. And I remember you pointed out also, you know, that in the past, I wasn't using my range. You seen that fight also, I had got cut, you know, fighting on the inside, and I had to, it was one of the things where I had to stick it out. But I remember before you know, going into that fight and during camp, you know, BOMAC and everyone, they told me that we're not here to change you, but we're here to improve what you can do. And like you said, it was more the mental aspect. You have to believe that you can do it and perform it when it really counts. So as you can see, over the last year or so, I started, you know, getting back to the basics. I started using my range, using my reach, and then putting it all together. So it took time, of course, building with the team, but we actually got it done.
How long did it take you to believe, to have that kind of mental shift? Was it the first fight? Was it a couple of fights into this new sort of
I believe, if I'm being honest, it was probably after the second fight. The second fight with Top Rank, when I fought Morale. And I easily cruised to a victory in that fight. But like I said, and then we had that chemistry. We all started building that stronger bond, as I may say. And when I started seeing that, you know, maybe I can just take it to the next level if I just, you know, believe in my ability and trust the team around me, you know, there's nothing that I can't do.
The other change, too, I mean, going to 130, is that a better fit for you than fighting at the 135 range?
I believe so. I believe every aspect that went around to in terms of changes in my career, it was all for a reason. And it all, you know, it turned out for the best for me, but More importantly, I believe it was more of the team around me, and just the you know, just building that chemistry with not only just my trainers, but having somebody like, you know, Bud Crawford in your corner, that doesn't help. That doesn't hurt either. You know, that doesn't hurt your chances of you know, really believing that you can do it. Especially when, if he says that he believes in you and thinks that you can do this better than anyone else in terms of this style, that says a lot.
How different was it for you to, you know, to go to Omaha and to work in these BOMAC camps? Was it different than what you'd experienced in previous stops along the way?
No, not really, because even during the Marine Corps, I was always traveling, and you know, I've been in different camps with the USA, with the USA Team USA. We was always in different camps, even in different countries. It just, like I said, if anything, it wasn't the location. It was more of, you know, everyone being on the same page and building that bond.
I mean, there's so much that a world title can do for you. I mean, not just stature, but, you know, financially, it right. means a lot. I mean, how much of a game changer is that for you?
I feel like when I had won the title, I felt a lot of weight was lifted off my shoulders, because at this point in my stage of my career, it's not just about me. Like you said, financially, it's basically taking care of my family. So when I won the title, it was just like, okay, you're basically – you're guaranteed another payday. You know, you guarantee even something bigger and down the road. So, yeah, most definitely. Once I won the belt, you could definitely see the changes now, you know, instantly, if I'm being honest. So, like I said, I'm still going to continue to, you know, train hard, because, you know, Bud, watching, being around Bud, he trains as is. He's still fighting for his first world title. So, you know, with that type of, you know, mentality around me, I feel like, you know, it's only going to make me better.
How would the 2016 version of you have fared in that fight against Ito?
Oh, I don't think I would have fared well in that fight. Like I said, I just felt like I was in a bad place. I wasn't getting the proper attention that I needed. And like I said, all credit to Ito. People could say that he probably wasn't the most – what is it? Not, I won't say talented, but the most experienced fighter, but he was determined. And you can see, like, even when I felt that the score was comfortable on my side, he was still willing to try anything to keep his title, and I had to respect that. So I don't think, you know, 2016, you know, Jamel Herring would be able to deal with that because, like I said, I fought hard with the Shavkat fight, but, you know, the pressure then during that fight, it eventually got to me and it broke me down.
Boxing cracks me up in this way that, like, you know, you get in the ring after a fight, you've just been punched in the head for 12 rounds, and everybody wants to know what you're going to do next. It's just like, there's no other sport where it's like that. When do you want to get punched in the head again? But, you know, you see Miguel Burchell hop into the ring.
Right.
Was that an immediate thought for you? Like, now I've got the title. I want another title. I mean, did that?
As you know, in today's boxing world, there's so many titles around and so many different fighters and, you know, different opinions come with those fighters. It's like you have to do something to stand out. And that's basically everyone trying to unify now because we all know, yeah, you can hold the title, but, you know, are you going to be considered a serious world champion unless you start fighting more serious competition? So, and I feel like I said, the mentality that I'm in now, it's like, what do I have to lose? Why not, you know, take my chances and see what I can do? A lot of people didn't think I was going to fare well with Ito. And then, you know, we cruised to a pretty comfortable victory that night. Without any, you know, anyone thinking that, oh, it was a robbery and things like that. So, like I said, with the team that I have now, I mean, Burchell is definitely a tougher challenge, of course. None of the champions are cakewalks, as a matter of fact. But I just feel like with the team and where I'm at as a person, if we just come with the right game plan like we did for the Ito fight, you know, we have a good chance of winning that fight.
Do you let yourself kind of start to dream at all about the mega fight that might be out there? I mean, you know, you want to unify, but, you know, you got Lomachenko kind of lurking in between right. Those weight classes, a fight that's makeable. Do you ever let yourself kind of think about how would I fare in a matchup with one of the best ever?
Oh, yeah. I mean, like I said, if you're a real fighter, you are, obviously you do want to fight the best. You know, of course, you could say some fighters, you know, do it for money. Like, we're not stupid. We know the fighters out there that just basically fight for the purse. But in the end, I want to leave a lasting impression. Even if I had to go out on my shield, I want to leave a lasting impression. And it's, why not fight the best out there? So, of course, I think about, you know, the Lomachenkos and guys like that. Because, like you said, it's not like it's no secret. Those fights are makeable. We are on the same under the same banner. The weight classes are fought in both weight classes now. So, you know, you gotta look at everything. You gotta be realistic. Like, you can't just sit there and say, oh, it'll never happen. Or no, you had, like I said, you got to be realistic, and but at the same time, just take everything one moment at a time.
Where does the first title belt go in the Herring home?
Do you
have a trophy case ready for it?
I definitely had to get that trophy case because, like I said,
right in the foyer,
I mean, you have to get that trophy case now because, like you pointed out, I mean, you always have that. As a fighter, you start looking at, you know, you want to collect more belts. Mm-hmm. So, of course, you know, okay, now we got to start the case and start, hopefully start adding more titles to it. But like I said, right now I'm just soaking it all in and just, you know, taking it one day at a time.
You got to wear it around the house a little bit too. Just like, you know, wake up in the morning on Sunday to strap on.
I don't think the wife would approve of that after a while. After a while, you know, like I said, you know, Jen is still, she's the boss at the house. You know, I may be the super featherweight champion of the world, but she's the heavyweight champion in the world in my household. So after a while, she'll get tired of seeing it.
Well, Jamel, great story. Great finish to it. Not a finish because you have more to come. Congratulations, man. And good luck. And thanks for joining me.
Thank you. Anytime, Chris.